No, because it was very clear from the beginning that Lil Wayne was obviously trying to get the Super Bowl slot. He grew up in New Orleans. He's been a New Orleans artist his entire life.
Whoa, listen. I hate to interrupt, but welcome to Hate to Interrupt, episode 21. I am Gulif, the introductory guy, and over to Culture.
I'm Nick from Stop Culture, Lil Wayne aficionado.
I'm a VHS guy, Nick, VHS guy official on YouTube. And we're going to have a quick announcement this episode. So, unfortunately, just due to some personal differences, Timmy is unfortunately leaving the pod. And I don't know, just sending that announcement out there into the ecosystem.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, we had a good time doing the pod with Tim, but we you know, it's kind of a mutual thing. We decided to go in different directions. But anyway, for this episode of the podcast, we're going to be discussing Shane Carruth's 2013 film, very experimental, kind of like an art film, I would say, Upstream Color.
Yeah.
And then we got a couple other topics that we're going to get into after. But this was Ethan's recommendation. So what made you want to recommend
this? This was mine. So Shane Carruth has been a filmmaker that I've heard about specifically from his probably more popular film Primer, which I've not
seen. I've seen that one.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Because I know, I was like, I've heard it's the one or one of the only time travel films where they actually make sense for like how the time travel functions. And it's also like, I think it was like $5,000 budget. It's made with like pennies.
What do you mean? Avengers Endgame totally made sense, dude.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Primer's impressive more so than it is good, I would say. But
okay. I still want to watch it.
But I liked it. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. But I just knew that this was his second movie, and we're doing kind of romance themed type vaguely centered movies, and I was like, "You know what? This is on my list. It's an incredibly low budget. I think the budget's like 50 to 100k, and it was shot on a GH2 camera, which is like a handheld camera. I think I have that right. So I was like, you know what? Sure, let's do this. I don't really know anything, so I'm going to go in blind. And it's weird.
Very weird.
I kind of have something on this. So I found a striking resemblance of this movie to this other movie that we've kind of mentioned every once in a while on the podcast. And that's that came to my head whenever I heard this line in the movie. I have a disfigurement where my head is made of the same material as the sun. And this made me think of this one scene in this little indie movie by Tommy Wiseau, where she goes, I got the test results back, and I definitely have breast cancer. That alongside with fucking Shane Carruth's acting, like, oh my fucking God.
You didn't like his acting?
He's so bad.
I thought he was all right.
So bad.
Wait, Nick, contextualize that, because you mentioned that line. I was like,
because
what?
Because it made no sense.
What part of the movie was it, though?
It was the sun line? This is at the beginning when the main character
just
is
first
being,
got the girl.
It's when the girl gets the maggot input into her stomach, and then she's like at the apartment, and it's basically his way of tricking her, being like, listen, my head is made of the sun, so it's really hard to look at, so you can't look directly at me. So then you get that really cool shot where she turns away and the bulb gets really bright on her face. I don't know, it was basically, I don't think that was bad. I think it was like the character, the fucking scumbag,
it was very, very cringy
done,
writing.
It's one of those lines where I'm like, he's done this like 40 times. It's like a script he's following.
Yeah.
So he's saying it with like no emotion in anything he's saying.
I was dying laughing when I heard it. I'm not saying, like, be that as it may, it's fine. Like, it doesn't make me hate the movie or anything, but I was literally laughing out loud whenever I heard that line.
My whole thing with this movie is like, I really conceptually, I thought it was very cool. I thought the larva mind control plot device was really interesting.
Yeah.
I just felt like it was a little bit too mumblecore for me. And I like mumblecore movies a lot, but like I felt like a movie like this, it has to rope you in to really, I don't know, care about these characters, and they're so fucking just so, like, like they don't, there's no emotion to any of these characters really until like 40 minutes in. I was like, okay, it's picking up a little bit, because I was waiting for that the entire time, and I was like, okay, it's finally here.
But for the viewers, does anybody want to attempt at trying to fucking explain the plot
of
this film?
So, Upstream Color is about a main character who gets essentially like a date rape drug Although its functions are very different, it basically allows you to become highly suggestible. And this guy who manufactures this serum that he gives people, gives it to her. She takes it, and essentially over the course of, I think, a few weeks or a month or something, she gives away all of her money to him, withdraws all of her bank accounts, sells all of her property, basically ruins her entire life giving money to this guy, and then leaves. And from then on, she is mentally affected, and her mind is kind of opened in a way and connected through this weird parasitic larva, and she meets another character who has had a similar history, and it's through their ties that they kind of have to unravel this mystery of what this is and how to stop it from happening. And yeah, it's, yeah. And there's pigs.
Yeah. So basically there's this weird, the whole movie is follows this weird cycle where basically this drug that this guy uses to take advantage of people grows, like, is taken from these worms that grow near this special flower that only grows near the dead body of these pigs. And the pigs are made from this guy inserting the worms that were inserted into the people back into the pigs. And then he just drowns the pigs and they float down to the river where these flowers grow. Like, it's the most contrived shit in the entire fucking world.
It is. It's one of those things where it sounds insane when you try to explain the mechanics, okay. But the way that I think the way they show it and the way you have to kind of figure it out yourself is more so what makes it engaging for me, because it was like a puzzle you're trying to figure out.
But my biggest problem with this movie is it's very much a movie. So, like, okay, if we take a look at Primer, which I guess you haven't seen Primer.
Yeah,
but Primer is very much a movie that you're meant to think about and try to piece everything together to really understand it. Like, but I feel like all of the information you actually need to understand Primer is hidden in the film. Like, there's a way to break down that movie and actually understand what happens. And this movie, it's very much made in a way that you're not supposed to have all the answers. And to understand this movie is to make that decision yourself what to believe. And I find that, this is a personal opinion, I find that to be very, very lazy and lame. Because I want the answers of the film to be in the film. I don't want to have to decide what to take from the film based on my own beliefs.
You don't like any ambiguity in film?
I'm not a big fan of it personally.
So what was, like, what did you not understand in this?
Well, first of all,
I feel like I have a pretty good grasp.
Well, I understand the actual premise of the movie, but like the guy, the pig guy, his whole situation made no fucking sense. It was like, it was literally like, you'd have to make up so many like ideas in your head as to why he's drowning these pigs in the water and like why he's putting these worms inside of people. Like, he felt like a plot device that I need to decide in my head why he exists and why he's doing these
things. Well, he's not putting the worms into people, he's taking them out of people. The other guy's putting them in
and
people.
Putting them into the pigs.
Yeah, well, yeah, the pigs. Where does the cycle actually start?
I think the point is that there is no, it's like a chicken and the egg type thing. Is that there is no real
piglet in the larva. But that's my point.
Piglet in the larva.
But that's my point, though, is like, I shouldn't have to tie all these loose ends on my own. It should be in the movie. You know, there should be somewhere I can understand this.
I get what you're saying. I understand, because I think it was about halfway, a little past the halfway point, I was starting to be like, all right, I'm getting really confused and I'm not getting a lot of answers. And then I think it was in the last 5 to 10 minutes when everything kind of like clicked. I was like, okay, all right, I fucking get what you're doing. Like, I don't know. I think it was fun, like, to essentially being sitting there just trying to figure it out. And also you have that, like, I love the mechanic of the pigs will go through something. And then you have the main characters will just be like, I feel like I'm trapped right now. Like, I'm like having a panic attack. And it's like, because they're like mentally connected to the larvas that are in the pigs. I think it's so cool.
Like, I think the movie's cool. Like, I think there's a lot of cool elements to this movie. It's just, it's like, it's that, like, because that on a baseline level, just like movies kind of leaving a lot of ambiguity and things for me to kind of piece together myself outside of like what's presented to me, that bothers me. And then also, like, I wish the performances were stronger in the film too. So like, but like, it's annoying because the movie was shot well. It looked really nice.
Yeah,
but
I mean, the movie is really highly reminiscent of Terrence Malick, Tree of Life, which I know, Nick, you've seen
that,
right?
I haven't seen Tree of Life, but I've heard a lot of people say that.
And the thing is, like, Tree of Life, I love, that's one of my favorite movies, actually. And I really didn't really like this movie that much. And I think not really. And the main difference, I think, between Tree of Life and this is that yes, it's still, it's very dreamlike. Like you're getting snapshots of the, of both of their lives and everything of, you know, the specific main characters of each story, but it still feels like Tree of Life really gives you an emotional center to care. There are powerful performances in that movie. There's powerful moments that make you feel things. And in this movie, it's like, these characters, I mean, they're literally, I guess, being mind controlled. So they're kind of not really in control of their actions, right? I mean, for a lot of it, or at least they're trying to figure out who is controlling their actions or whatever. But yeah, I don't know, man. It was a slog to get through for me. I was having a hard time.
I think that's a really good example. Cause like for me, it like felt like it was this movie was an attempt for him to make us kind of like feel something as opposed to like,
mm-hmm.
like have like a like he had a really good idea for like a plot of a film, right? Like he wanted to make us feel something, but I didn't really feel much from it. Mm-hmm. You know, and Tree of Life does do that, but better. It also kind of reminded me of a Philip K. Dick book or something, like a Scanner Darkly but worse, you know what I mean?
Yeah I could see that. Scanner Darkly is such, we should talk about that one time, but
it's a good movie.
I mean, what did you really like it, Ethan?
I really like this. I I'm sitting like, I know you haven't done scores yet, but I'm like an 8 out of 10. I want to watch it again. I've seen it twice at this point because I was like, all right, I get what you're doing. But then I rewatched it this morning, like rewatched/listened to it this morning after I'd already seen it, just to kind of like go into, which is very hard because there's very little dialogue in this movie. I really like what it's going for. I like, sure, the characters aren't 100%, but I think there's enough there for me to bite onto. Like I really like the detail when they start first meeting up and talking, and you just get that small moment of her pulling out the pills and putting them on the table and being like, oh yeah, this is what I'm taking because my life is like fucked. And it's like you can assume that her life has been just completely just demolished in the last few months. I just like little details like that. They don't have to bring a bunch of attention to it. I did notice actually there was specifically for Shane Carruth's character, which I think his name is like Josh or something.
Jeff.
It's with, yeah. I think there was some weird ADR, but I think that also just comes into working with the low budget that they were given. I mean, I think this is like entirely self-funded.
I think the movie looked pretty good. But like a big part of the issue for me is like because there weren't a lot of dialogue scenes and like what you're kind of saying, a lot of it did kind of feel like random B-roll, like for like large portions of the movie. It just felt like they were just throwing B-roll in there, like, and it didn't really, it felt, and it was kind of chopped together in kind of a weird order too. So it kind of just felt a little bit aimless and like with just the visual portion of it.
But it like it felt aimless to me, but then it didn't once I kind of had answers. Like I was like, okay, you're showing me weird stuff. The only thing I don't really have a definitive answer for that I'm like still unsure of is the guy running who was like taking care of the pigs. I don't really know what the whole sound obsession was of him going around like creating sounds. I know they link that back, and I also love how they edited that whole thing where he's like making sounds and then it shows him on the mixer mixing them, and then that plays into the soundtrack and edits back and forth. That was so good, but I don't really know what that was going for other than having it tie back in later where the characters are recreating the sounds they've been hearing. So I'm not sure. That's the one thing I'm unsure of.
This is one of those films where like I think it shows a lot of promise for like the director. Like I think he's a really solid director. First of all, he shouldn't have cast himself for that, because I think the actress was actually pretty decent.
I think they were dating. I think that's why they were.
But she was actually pretty good. I don't necessarily think she was bad. I just think
Amy Simons, I think her name is. Yeah.
I mean, if anything, it's the direction for me. It's the fact that they're both just so monotone throughout the entire film. It was really, really difficult for me to get invested in either of their stories, despite the fact that, like I said, I felt like conceptually it's such a cool thing to have this guy who's drugging them with this fucking weird larva drug that controls their mind, and then he like drains their bank accounts. That was really cool. And then, you know, the cyclical thing about it too, how I guess the larva, you know, you don't really know where it starts, but the fact that the pigs are involved in it somehow, and they gestates inside the pigs and goes through the water and becomes the orchids, like that is cool. It's just like it didn't really click for me as a movie altogether. I will say there are certain visual things that I really liked, like how when you see the worms like crawling through her skin, and that's kind that of mirrored great. By her like flailing around on the bed, and her arms are kind of being worm like. I thought that was cool. And they do that like once they're both together in bed too. There's a lot of cool things like that in the movie.
I liked it. I didn't love it. I think it was cool. I'm happy I watched it. I'm like, it's a good recommendation for sure, and something worth kind of seeing.
It's very interesting. That's my biggest takeaway.
Yeah, and I think I wish I would have gathered some info on it, but I heard that Shane Carruth had some weird shit happen to him. Like, he's kind of a piece of shit.
All I know is that the actress in this, Amy Simetz, I think her name is. I think I already said it. Yeah, Amy Simetz. They were dating, and in 2018 she got a temporary restraining order for abusive tendencies, and then in 2020 it became a permanent restraining order. But Shane Carruth has had no comments on such. So he doesn't seem like he'd be a great guy.
That, and I've also heard he said some like just weird shit about the film industry in general. I think he's kind of
got
himself
blacklisted.
He's a very
indie guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
He also said, I think it was like, he's seems more just frustrated that like he had funding for a movie called like The Last Wave or something. It was like, or maybe like The Big Wave. And it was like Anne Hathaway was going to be in it, and some big names, but the funding kept like falling through and like not getting finalized. And he was just like pissed off because this guy makes like one movie every decade. He made this in 2013, and then he made Primer in 2006 or 2007. And he's had another movie in the works for forever, but I mean
another
interesting character.
It's kind of this film kind of has like a Donnie Darko syndrome going on, where there's just like it gets bogged down by the weight of its own mythology that it's trying to create, you know. Whereas like, I mean, Nick, you sent that like photo thing, the cycle in the group chat or whatever, and that was definitely, was that fan made, or
that was part of the marketing, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, so like Donnie Darko also did stuff like that, and it's like if you need to sell that kind of stuff or hand it out in tandem with your release, like it may be a little bit too much going on in the
movie.
I
personally,
you know,
think the ambiguity in Donnie Darko is what sells it for me, at least. Like, I think like if you watch the director's cut where it explains fucking everything, like that ruins the fucking movie for me. The theatrical cut where everything isn't explained, I think it gives you enough there to kind of like piece it together yourself more so than this movie does. But I see what you're talking about.
I mean, Donnie Darko is the theatrical cut is still incredibly ambiguous, though. I mean,
that's what I'm talking about. Director's cut? The director's cut adds a bunch of like explanation to everything.
No, yeah, I know. The director's cut is kind of leaning towards more of this film. I mean, this film didn't have like the cutaways and every, you know, remember the director's cut, it had all those like, oh,
it added a bunch of extra scenes.
There was like pages that you had to read that they would cut in between scenes. It was a lot, you know.
Yeah.
And this film doesn't have that much going on, but it's still a lot, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting because like once I've laid out all the details like about the actual story structure, it doesn't seem like that complicated. It's not super
It's not that complicated, confusing. But it also it doesn't make much sense, and that's my problem.
In like what way?
The entirety of the pig guy makes no sense to me. Like, why is he drowning pigs in the fucking river?
Well, because he's drowning them because their bodies decay, and then it mixes into the water, and then it goes into the roots of the tree and grows flowers.
As far as what's made available in the story, he has no idea that any of this is going on.
Oh, I think I assumed he was like a part of this whole like group that, you know, the people that collect the flowers, then they send that off to the guy that makes the maggots, and then he does the whole thing where he tricks people, and then the maggot people, all the people with the maggots in them.
I think he's a completely separate third party.
And then all the people with the maggots go, he lures the people with the sounds from his speakers, and then he takes out the maggots, he transplants them into the pig, raises them, they have piglets, he drops the piglets in, they die. That's the cycle, and I feel like he is a part of that, because once he's done, the cycle breaks. Like the people at the very end are like, what the hell, we don't have any more.
But I don't think the people who gather the things know that he's the cause for that. I think they're all completely separate. That's the whole point.
I don't think
though.
So because they looked, they were like confused, like where the fuck are my blue flowers, you know, and they're sending the flowers to the guy who makes the worms.
Exactly. They don't know where, they were like, where are the flowers? Because the other guy, they didn't even know he existed. They didn't know he was the reason that the flowers existed.
I just interpreted it as like, I don't know, they're all working as like a company, essentially, like a small business that commits fraud.
Wait, do you think it's possible? Is it possible that the power of his sick hipster beats are what's creating the psychoactive properties of these larvas?
Hell yeah.
Possibly.
That would be fucking awesome if he was like a hipster Pied Piper, you know?
That would made the story make a little bit more sense to me.
He's leading all the yuppies to their demise and their bank accounts being drained.
That's the problem. See, like, I don't think either of us can necessarily be proven wrong on our point by this film.
Yeah.
I think what information is available in the movie, either of us could technically be right. And that's my problem with
the movie. I love that. There's different interpretations. It's art, man. We're talking about art here.
Interpretation kind of guy. You only like one interpretation.
I want the person who made a movie to have a vision, and I want them to make that vision come to life. And I feel like he didn't necessarily have a complete vision.
So you want him to show up at the credits, be like, thank you for watching my movie.
Listen up. here's what happened.
If you did not take this, you are a fucking idiot, and I wish you didn't watch the movie, actually.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, it reeks of like not being able to come up with a concrete idea in the writing phase.
Well, I mean, I think it's a solid idea.
What is he really trying to say with it? Because I mean, it definitely goes for a happy, like vegan ass type of ending, where the ultimate the moral of the story here is that really what we want, what all the viewers wanted, was just a happy life for all these piglets. No one wants to see little, you know, Winnie the Pooh's friends fucking drowning in a stream in a burlap sack. So if we can get a PETA type, you know, Pamela Anderson type ending where the pigs are being taken care of. Everyone's joining up at the pig farm because of Walden for some reason. And then, you know, everyone's happy. I mean, what is that? Is he trying to say something about, like, I don't know, taking control of their trauma or something? And, like, recontextualizing
it? I think it's part of that, yeah.
I think it's like free will.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think it's like how much your life is impacted from external, like, sources, and like how much of like who you are is based on like how other things impact you.
Yeah,
that's how I took it.
And since it's almost Valentine's Day, it's about power of love.
Wait, so is this movie like marketed as a romance film?
I don't think I was like, they're a couple in the movie, and
I saw that it's like a weird sci-fi romance.
Yeah, I mean, the poster kind of has that vibe where they're both they're laying in the bathtub and everything. I mean, so there's an indisputable psychic bond that happens between all of the people who take the larva, right?
Seemingly,
That was a cool thing about it when they started. They were actually doing Call Me By Your Name. Did you hear that? They were like, Chris. Wait, no, I'm Chris. Remember that?
Yeah, they were like having the memories where they were just like, that was, I knew that kid who pushed me down the water slide or whatever. And they're like, no. That was me. I grew up. I think that was super interesting. That was when I was starting to be like, what the fuck is happening? But it made sense once you get to the later
parts. I was waiting for the peach pit to fucking pop out. I was like, who's busting in a peach? I want to see if fucking Chalamet bust out into a peach in this movie. That would make me go from a 5 to an 8 if they had a scene like that. But.
Yeah.
I'm like a 5.5 on it, probably. I think I like maybe a little more than you. I just I don't know.
Yeah, it was definitely an interesting watch for sure. I kept on really asking the movie to like give me a reason to care about the characters beyond just being having like a vague level of intrigue and what all of the plot mechanics are. And it never really gave me that, even by
that's
the end,
fair.
You know. So I was kind of just like, it's okay. I saw Primer a while ago. I remember liking that one. So maybe I'll give that another
watch. Does that have a good emphasis on characters, or is that more of like a mechanics-based story?
The characters don't really matter in Primer as much.
But is it like, would you say Primer is one of those stories where you're like, I don't need the characters to be strong. I just want the story to be engaging.
I think there's a lot more intrigue in it. And I think you're like, I think it like makes you want to understand things more than this movie.
Okay.
I barely remember it. I saw it a long time ago.
We gotta talk about
the early 2000s, right? It's like an old movie.
It's 2006, I think.
Yeah.
Mid-2000s. I don't remember it that much.
Interesting interesting detail I read. Oh, 2004. I read that he when Rian Johnson finished writing Looper, he sent the script to Shane Carruth because they were both like indie guys.
Mm-hmm.
And Shane Carruth was like, the time travel fucking sucks. It makes no sense.
In Looper?
Fix it. In Looper. And he's like, time travel sucks. And then Rian Johnson was like, well, it's too late. I can't really. Script's done.
I didn't like Looper very much. I
thought Looper was cool.
I thought it was cool, but like, no.
I remember the scene when they're
Rian Johnson's
when they're talking when Bruce Willis is talking to fucking Joseph Gordon-Levitt in the diner. That's a fucking unironically epic scene when he's like, he's talking to his younger self,
and
he's like, dude, you're a fucking idiot. You have no idea. I would love the chance to talk to my younger self and be like, you're a piece of shit. You have no idea what's coming, buddy. Just wait. And that's like,
I think the concept was cool. I don't know. But have y'all seen this, Rian Johnson's first movie, Brick, with a.
No, that was with a.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
His name. Yeah. I have not seen
that. That movie fucking very fucking good.
We've covered on this before, but I'm tired of the Rian Johnson hate train. There's a gravy train online where everyone fucking hates on Rian Johnson for some reason. Like, I got into a fucking argument with someone in our Discord they were so mad that remember the part in Knives Out when he's like, Hugh, or the woman's like, Hugh did this. They thought that was like the worst thing to ever happen in a movie. Like, it totally broke the plot mechanics, the logic mechanics or whatever of the movie. And
it's,
I was just, like,
it's kind
of
goofy, but that's it.
They were like, everyone calls him Ransom the whole time, and then she says Hugh. I'm like, well, she's fucking dying. She's dying. She's like on her last breath. She's gonna say whatever's quicker, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't
personally love that movie, but also I don't hate Rian Johnson. I think The Last Jedi is a dog shit, but like I don't hate him as a person. I think he's directed some good Breaking Bad episodes. I think Brick was good. I think Looper was serviceable. Knives Out, I mean, for that, it's just like, why the fuck did you tell me who the fucking murderer was like 30 minutes into the fucking movie? Like,
you just they don't tell you that. 30 minutes in.
It felt really early.
Yeah, they do. They tell you what they solve the murder for you, basically. Then you find out that there's like, you know, Ransom is the spoilers. Ransom is the kind of ultimate villain of it, but not because he killed the guy.
I see what you guys are talking about. The mix up in the morphine.
Yeah.
Okay. I liked that because from the beginning I was like, okay, but there's still something going on, and then by the time you get to the second part, you're like, okay, there has been some meddling with shit. I liked it,
dude.
I can see the appeal. It's more one of those things where I watched it also like right after The Last Jedi, and I was just like, oh my god, I'm just not getting what I expected just to fucking be different. Like, it just felt annoying,
dude. Shane Carruth telling Rian Johnson that his the time travel mechanics suck reminds me of when if I would put out a video and be like, Nick, what do you think of this thumbnail? He's like, fuck, it sucks, dude. But I'm just like, it's too late, bro. It's already up.
Sorry.
I didn't say that, bro. I never said it sucked. I just said change the color.
Yeah.
Of one text for it.
Well, I mean, I have a this is kind of an interesting topic that I've been thinking about for at least like a week now. It's the fact that I don't know if, you know, we've talked about this privately, but I don't know if you guys have been giving it any thought, but it's a pretty interesting phenomenon that I'm noticing, that basically all of the best directors in Hollywood right now have very little to almost no interest in telling movies that are set in the modern era, like post 2010. So what I did was I gathered up the filmographies of, what is this, like 10, 11 directors, like top brass Hollywood directors, to just see how many of them are actually telling stories about the present day. So I rounded up Scorsese, Tarantino, Eggers, Nolan, Luca Guadagnino, Spielberg, Ridley Scott, Yorgos Lanthimos, Coen Brothers, PTA, and Denis. And for their entire post-2010 output, only 85% of the films that they've made are not set in the present day. And that kind of coincides with this quote that's been going around from Robert Eggers, where he's like, the idea of having to photograph a car. I mean, he takes it farther because he doesn't want to even have a fucking car in his movies.
Makes him like, ill.
Yeah, but like the idea of photographing a cell phone is just death, is what he says. And I think that's kind of where this all stems from, like the concept or the challenge of depicting the most common mode of communication for millennials and Zoomers and basically everybody nowadays is fucking texting. And texting is like the most uncinematic action that you can do on screen. So, I mean, I don't know. I'll pose a question to you guys. Like, why do you think that is? Why is nobody why are all these guys not interested in telling stories about today?
I think it's two things. One, most of these motherfuckers are old as shit.
That's what I was thinking. They're old.
And they probably have this like thing in their head where older days are better. That's one. Also, I think that a lot of them are probably trying to base things around like big events that happened in time, like, or in a time period of something happening in time. And I think having more separation from those events makes it an easier topic to touch on. Mm-hmm. And it's not like something that people are directly living in right now. And I mean, I definitely don't think texting is very cinematic. I agree with you there. I think text, like, especially whenever they try to like make that shit like show up on screen, like showing you like that. The screen on camera,
like,
or like having
up.
The pop
yeah.
up.
Yeah.
I hate that. I think
it's really difficult.
I think these are great directors, and I think if they really needed to make it work somehow, they would find a way around it to make it look cinematic. So I don't know that it necessarily has to do with avoiding modern times specifically.
I mean, I think it does. I mean, it's just like listen to specific numbers. Marty, zero out of the six movies he's made since 2010, none of them have been set in present day. Tarantino, 0 for 4. Eggers, 0 for 4. Nolan's 4 out of 6, but all four of those they involved like fantasy plots. Luca is 2 out of 7. Spielberg's 1 out of 9. Ridley Scott, 2 out of 11. Yorgos, 4 out of 7. Coen Brothers, 0 out of 7. PTA, 0 out of 4. And Denis has told a lot of present day things, but again, a lot of fantasy stuff, which I kind of like put that in a separate category, because it's like, I'm thinking about what is it about the actual world that we live in that to these guys isn't very interesting to tell stories about? Like, it's kind of depressing to me, because I did another round of this too, where I went through a lot of these guys pre-2009 work, and 47% of those films were set in the present day. So there's a lot more of an opportunity or a desire for them to want to talk about what's going on around them. All of these guys are stuck in the past now, which makes me feel like, I don't know, like the greatest visual storytellers of our time have nothing to say about now. It's kind of strange.
I think there's a couple points. Like VHS Nick said, they're all older, which, not to say that there's anything wrong with that, except for like someone like Eggers, I think he's 40. And to think of the amount of time between, you were saying 2010-ish,
yeah.
2010 to 2024, that's 14 years, versus the creation of film in the early 1900s to 2010 is a massive expanse. And I know they're telling stories about films, or telling stories from beyond, like even before that. But I don't know. I think just a lot of it is grown up with that. And I think maybe it's just because it's so new and it is so weird to film someone with a phone that it's just, maybe it'll just take a little bit to get to that. I don't know. Are there many movies that came out in the 90s that had people talking on phone, like tech from that time period?
I mean, yeah. Tarantino, you know, his pre-2010 output, 6 out of those 7 movies were present day. So
you could also look
just like
at
within
from,
5 years, you know.
Okay.
You also, there is also like a simplification of communication nowadays that makes writing stories a lot less interesting too. Like,
yeah,
we're texting each other constantly. Everybody's always constantly in communication with each other. Like, whereas back in the day, you know, it was a lot harder to just contact people every day, right? It was kind of an undertaking. If you're out and about, you have to go find a payphone. You can't just warn somebody about something immediately, right? If somebody's in danger, they can't just open their phone and be like, hey, blah blah blah, you know. So especially in drama, I think it takes a lot of the drama out of it,
or horror as well,
communication in your fingertips, you know,
which is why they have like those signal blockers or signal boosters or whatever the fuck. They'll be like, oh, you trying to use your cell phone, lady? It's not gonna fucking work.
Or you get that line, how many times in a horror movie have you seen the like, damn it, I've got no service?
Yeah,
exactly.
No, I mean, so much about like dramatic tension in movies, I think, is about who knows what, which character knows what piece of information at what specific time during the movie. So if you have a device that can technologically let everyone know exactly what's happening in the movie. Some of the tension is going to abate in whatever scene you're trying to ramp up tension in, which kind of makes it more difficult. But
yeah, and if they're trying to figure something out, they can just pull up ChatGPT to explain everything for them, you know?
I mean, it'll tell them wrong information.
Yeah. I would like to say there were a couple people that actually do tend to like telling stories about the present day, which was David Fincher, who is an older guy, but almost all of his movies are set in the modern era. I mean, not Zodiac, but most of them are set in the present day, which I thought was interesting. And then they're like people like Greta. I thought this was an interesting phenomenon too that I noticed with Greta Gerwig and Denis Villeneuve, that earlier in their careers they were doing present day movies, but then as they got more acclaim and bigger budgets, they started to go back into the past. They, like, you know, Greta Gerwig's early films were a lot like, you know, HBO's Girls, like that kind of vibe, like kind of hipster Brooklyn, you know,
it's like Frances Ha, right?
Yeah, Frances Ha, Girl Against the City kind of movies, you know, which are really good too. But as she started to develop as a voice, she was like, oh, I'll do Little Women or I'll do Lady Bird, where that's set.
And now she's doing Narnia.
Is she really? I forgot.
Yeah, she's doing the new Narnia movies. Wow. For that one specifically, that to me just screams of like, I don't got fucking money, so it's set in modern day. And now I'm like, I have a budget. I'm going to go back and tell a story. You know, we can do a period piece now. Whereas like if you were like, hey, Greta Gerwig at the time of Frances Ha or at the time of Lady Bird was like, can you take this money and go make a period piece? I mean, I'm sure she could, but it wouldn't be to the level. And also it helps that Little Women is also a famous story. But like a lot of that is like, it's kind of the only option for a lot of these creators is you said it modern day because you could, you know, because that's your option.
Yeah. I mean, if you guys were going to set out to make a movie, because you guys are both filmmakers, you know? So like, if you had all the money in the world, like would setting mean that much to you? Would it be something you consider when you're out, you know, sitting down to write a script, or would you?
I think it's one of the first things you consider, honestly.
I think it depends. Yeah. If you can take a story that's interesting enough and you go, how much of this story's context will change if it's set in, say, the 70s or in the early 1900s? And does it work? Does it make it worse? Does it make it better? I don't know. I think that's very interesting.
Yeah. And I think a lot of writers, like they kind of have like an illusion of like what the story is going to kind of look like in their head. And that a lot of that is to do with the time and how people look and things like that, you know?
Yeah.
Does Bong Joon-ho's filmography mostly present day?
I didn't go through his, but
it's modern day stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So he's another one that likes modern day.
Yeah. Yeah. There are definitely exceptions to it and everything, but it's wild to me. Like I was very surprised because I had the thought, and then once I started going through a lot of the, you know, I tried to think of, I left out Bong Joon-ho. That's kind of a huge miss on my part, but to think of directors that most cinephile type people would think were like A and S tier. You know, and
it's like, a fun thought process for sure. I mean, it gives you, there's just so many different reasons you could probably attribute it to. And I think that's like, I think it's going to come down to all of those reasons, right? Like depending on the film.
I have this, there's one quote from Scorsese that's pretty interesting. This is actually him talking about how he's not really a big fan of new movies that are coming out, but it sort of relates to what we're talking about a little bit. He says, there's oversaturation, particularly in our world as it is now, and nothing really does have a meaning. Images, for example, are everywhere. Cinema used to be in a building, and even on television you'd see a film or whatever. I must say a lot of the films that I'm aware of, and I don't see that many new ones over the past couple of years because I stopped feeling like the images mean anything. Well, this is kind of an inarticulate quote, sorry. But we're just completely saturated with images that don't mean anything. Words certainly don't mean anything anymore. They're twisted and turned. So where's the meaning? Where's the truth? We have to strip away everything. So I mean, I don't know. I'd like to me, like, That kind of speaks to the fact that everybody has their own truth now, because we all lead such insular lives. Like another thing, this kind of goes back to the logistics of trying to film smartphones or film the modern world or anything, but like, not only is it immersion breaking to remind people that, you know, when you're out at the movies or when you're watching something at home, like, you don't want to remind people of another screen that they have to use throughout their daily lives that they're probably not too stoked about fucking having to look at, because everyone's lives nowadays are, you know, just intervals of staring at three different screens that you have, whether it's in your pocket or your desk or your fucking, you know, your office or whatever.
I don't think that younger people think that way, though. I think that's something that we maintain because we had a period in our life where we didn't have that. But I think as younger people are kind of growing up in that world, I don't think that's something they necessarily think about or think negatively about.
No, I mean, if they didn't think that way, like, touch grass wouldn't be a meme, you know. if people, everyone knows that. But, I mean, people talk about that, like, screen the, time constantly. Like, you know, people know that screens aren't good for you.
But that's all coming through, like. But that's all coming through, like, Zoomers and things like that, you know? And those are people that were, like, kind of, like, the last generation. Like, we act like it was us as millennials. So, like, it really is them, the last generation of people that kind of had that, like, real childhood, you know? So we'll have to see, you know, over the next, like, 10 years how things shake out and how people feel about those kind of things. But
I mean, I would say there's already a backlash to it now. I mean, people... They do, I think, kind of, whether it's out of a sort of addiction that they have or out of necessity for work or just, you know, interacting. A lot of people, like I said, people live insular lives and end up, like, like we've done, honestly, like, just making friendships through fucking Discord and YouTube and stuff like that. Like,
that's true.
I would have never imagined myself having, you know, I mean, you guys are, like, my good friends at this point, and, like, I've never met you. And that's, like, to me, that's not something I ever imagined myself doing, you know?
It definitely does feel harder these days to kind of put yourself out there. And, like, the only way I go meet real people is, like, going out to, like, I don't even drink, but I sometimes, like, I'll just go to bars and just talk to people just so I can, like, actually have some kind of, like, interaction with people. So, I mean, I 100% agree with you. I just don't want to put words in younger people's mouths and say that they necessarily feel the same way, you know?
Well, Ethan's younger.
I'm a Zoomer, technically.
Dude, holy shit. Yours, I feel like...
I think I'm in the last year of Zoomer, so...
Do you feel... Are you like, technically a cusper?
Pretty much, yeah.
So, if you had to identify with one of the generations, where would you stick yourself?
Because, what is it, millennials and Zoomers? That's where I'm stuck between.
What year were you born?
99.
Oh, no, so you're full-on Zoomer. You're like, you're not a cusper at all. Like, cuspers are 96, maybe 97.
Oh, okay, then no, I'm a Zoomer.
Yeah.
I was a 90s kid for 5 months or whatever.
Only 90s
even
kids.
I don't know, so even I don't feel like a 90s kid. Like, I feel like I grew up mostly in the 2000s. Like, that's what I remember as my childhood, like the early 2000s.
Yeah,
I don't know, like, I feel like... Even if I don't feel like I identify with one group or the other as much. I feel like there's things I caught where I became influenced by things that were popular for millennials as well as things that were popular for Zoomers. It was just kind of a mishmash. I've never been like, hey, look at this fucking loser. He's got a Deathly Hallows tattoo.
I think that. And I'm a millennial. So
if you guys had to pick, you know, we're talking about a lot of directors that like to depict the past, but if you had to pick a favorite director of yours that you feel like really captures the essence of, like, the post-pandemic era, like the 2020s, who is that for you guys?
That really captures the post-pandemic?
Yeah, like this era, that is this exact moment that we're in right now. Not, I mean, I didn't mean to say, like, pandemic, like, anything to do with COVID. I'm just saying.
Oh, okay. Just now. I always say
post-pandemic because you know my life totally changed in 2020. So I was always like before. It's like AD and BC for me.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, I can't. I'm trying to like picture movies that
I was
came
gonna
out
say. Like I guess right now, I feel like I'm gonna say Luca Guadagnino, but I'm not really like confident on that answer.
I don't.
Yeah, I don't know if there's been enough time
captured the era. Like, what has he done that's set modern? I haven't seen Queer yet. I guess.
I mean,
Challengers didn't even feel modern though. Challengers felt like a.
They use smartphones.
I know, but I feel like all like the lighting and like everything made it feel like it was like set in like the '80s or something. To me, at least.
Luca perfectly captures the specifically Gen Z urge to bite the fingers off of your new hot vagabond girlfriend that you met outside, you know, and bones and all.
Yeah, it truly captures the male urge to make out with your best friend, your bros.
I mean, honestly, like, I mean, I slapping your I bros. Don't know. It's hard for me to think. I mean, I think like Lady Bird captured the essence of that era that it was in really well.
Yeah, but Lady Bird. Like, I mean, like, yeah, that's the thing with Greta Gerwig is interesting because I feel like even though she's, I think she's like in her late 30s at this point now, but she kind of. She feels like a Gen Z storyteller to me almost because I don't like Barbie. I don't know. You guys think Barbie was more of a millennial or Gen Z thing? I feel like it was kind of just a girl thing all over. But
I think it was just one for the girls.
Yeah.
It was a bit in between.
So you were kind of in high school in like that 2010s era, Nick, too, because you're the same age as me.
Yeah.
You know what movie like I feel like perfectly like kind of encapsulates?
Are you going to say
like,
Superbad? Feeling-
No, not super.
Oh, okay.
The kind of that feeling of like my like later high school years and just kind of like how everybody acted and kind of viewed the world is Youth in Revolt, that Michael Cera movie. Did you ever watch that?
I watched that, like back in the day. Yeah, I don't remember it too well, but
when I think of like my high school days, I think of that movie a lot.
That's where I got the idea for my mustache from. From Michael Cera's
was his name the iconic mustache was from that movie. Oh man!
Believe it or not, Michael Cera inspired my fucking mustache, damn. Dude.
Can he even grow a mustache? Well,
no.
Can't.
I feel like it'd look weird on his face. No.
He grows like a Chalamet mustache.
Oh no!
It's like a little mustache. It's a little flavor saver.
I love him. I think he's hilarious.
I think he's funny too. Yeah, that's a terrible mustache. No offense, Michael.
Do you ever see the CeraVe commercials he does? Where he's like, I'm Michael, and this is my cream, CeraVe.
Oh, man. I'm making a video. I guess we can, if y'all have
wait, real quick. I feel like the movie that defined my generation, because everyone was talking about it in high school, was Pitch Perfect.
Really? You think so?
I think so. I don't think that movie's very good, and I think it's very cringe and of the time if you go back and watch it now. But that was like... Every kid was like, dude, that was so funny. And that was so sick when they sang a cappella.
Yeah, no, I mean, wait, it's funny that you said Superbad because for me, that probably was the movie, or at least my high school years. It definitely did feel like me and my friends we watched that movie constantly and we thought it was so fucking funny and so cool. And we like emulated moments from it and stuff, like all that corny shit you do when you're kids and you love movies. Mm-hmm. But, actually, I don't know if you guys are going to feel me on this, but I feel like randomly one of the best film series that really captures what it feels like to exist in the 2020s are the Spider-Verse films, actually, because there's so much stimulus in those movies. Like those movies totally just go full bore on the TikTok era. Like we're just going to throw like a million fucking things on the screen, but it's still going to feel artful and new and cool and make you feel something. Like
that's cool.
Yeah,
and I think a movie's going to be like mega successful is because if I hear like family members who are under the age of 11 talking about it, they're like, dude, did you see Spider-Verse? And I'm like, this is going to be a fucking huge film.
That's honestly like that's a really good example, because I think Phil Lord and Chris Miller, like the directors, are kind of like very like Gen Z, like modern day like directors as far as like their style. Like even like the 21 and 22 Jump Street movies, like they're very like fast paced, like. I think they are a good example of directors that kind of fit the modern era. Really
they
well.
Didn't direct Spider-Verse. I think they wrote it.
Oh, really? Yeah, I always thought they were the main creative force behind that.
I think they're part of their writing team or something like that, but the director is Kemp Powers, I think.
No, okay.
Yeah, this is very much a Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas situation.
Oh, like the Henry Selick guy?
He directed. It's Joaquin Dos Santos, Kemp Powers, and Justin K. Thomas are the directors. Writers are Phil Lord, Chris Miller, and Dave Callahan.
Okay.
Wait, so one more before we go on to the thing that Nick wants to talk about. I wanted to ask you guys something that's sort of related to this, but I feel like we're sort of seeing, because I think millennial film, millennial culture, like so much things about millennial culture of the 2010s was defined by this sense of like ironic detachment. So much of our music was like, dude, I don't fucking care, like slacker rock and shit like that. And, you know, sort of a resurgence of those like mumblecore movies, like the Jason Duplass stuff was really big at that time. And I think now, I feel like personally, Zoomers are more interested in like sincerity and earnestness, but that might just be my impression.
No, I think that's absolutely true. Yeah, I think it's become more cringe to, and like if you're openly sarcastic, like my life sucks, like that's super embarrassing. Yeah. Like I don't know. I think someone just being like, "Yeah, I'm fucking hot," is like way more engaging at this point.
I think one of the big jokes whenever we were in like high school or like fresh out of it is like, "I'll just kill myself." Like everybody it's wants like, to fucking off themselves. It's like, dude, come on.
You're just holding a Ray Dunn mug with a fucking Xbox Live controller. You're just like, I'm gonna fucking kill myself. I hate being a millennial. I'm so fucking sad that JK Rowling broke my heart. She fucking killed my childhood.
Yeah, it's fucking rough.
But okay, so what's your thing, Nick?
I guess so I'm making a video right now. It's kind of about experimentation in sitcoms and why I think it's important, because I think the genre is dying out. But do y'all have any connection to any sitcoms growing up that like kind of connected to you for any reason, and why is that?
Oh, I have so many sitcoms because like the main thing that I would watch before school, you know, like getting ready for the bus, I was one of those weird kids that just like I would get up really early so I could take a shower and then just like sit in bed and watch like reruns of fucking Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and shit like that, you know. So I love just having time to myself before school. So I watched that. I watched Cosby Show. I watched fucking Saved by the Bell. I watched, and then, you know, a lot of the other Nickelodeon stuff. Yeah, dude. Oh, that 70s show is still probably my favorite.
That
70s
show is fucking good.
I watched a lot of That 70s Show as a kid.
Yeah.
But my problem with sitcoms, which I watched a fucking shitload of sitcoms too, but like I don't think as a genre it was very sustainable. Because like they're doing the same things over and over. It's the same situations, different family. Am I crazy?
I guess, but that's just the genre.
But it keeps working though, I feel like, right? I mean,
but is it still working? Like, what's the last big sitcom that was like huge?
I think a lot of
Modern Family, probably.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, Modern Family,
that's still
the
super
Schitt's
popular.
Creek.
The sort of multicam live studio audience sitcom has definitely died a death for sure.
Yes,
but I think that there were also a lot of attempts to revive that. Like, I don't know if you guys remember Lucky Louie. That was a thing that they were doing, that Louis C.K. did on HBO in the early 2010s. John Mulaney had a failed sitcom. Do you remember that? It was kind of like a Seinfeld ripoff that really didn't do so well. Only lasted a season.
I think that's part of the problem, though, is like that they kept making these sitcoms that the only point of the sitcom was basically market this up and coming comedian. They had one for Martin, which Martin was actually pretty good. They had one. They had one for like every comedian though in the early 2000s. Yeah. Like every single comedian had their own sitcom.
Martin was very funny, I thought. And
Martin was funny.
I don't know. I think that if you take into consideration, this is going back a little bit, but Parks and Rec, The Office. I guess that's
classics.
That's literally 20 years ago now, so never mind. But Schitt's Creek, Modern Family.
Oh,
like
I love
Ethan
Schitt's
said.
Creek. Yeah.
And then like I don't know, Always Sunny is a sitcom, right? And fucking,
but that also started in like 2004.
Yeah, it's still going, still chugging,
it's still
along.
Going strong.
And they got Abbott Elementary and shit.
So, yep, so my pitch of the video is basically like that, like these weird sitcoms, like sitcoms that kind of are kind of like outside of the realm of reality are kind of what can keep sitcoms alive, which my examples are like
Mork and Mindy.
Like Alf early on. There's Mork and Mindy's a good one.
Young
there's,
Sheldon.
I think fucking Always Sunny I would consider like a weird sitcom because it's an entire group of sociopaths
that are
like
horrible
no
people.
Connection to reality, right?
Yeah.
Like that's not, they're not a normal family, right? And then we have like Third Rock from the Sun. We have I had a whole list of them in my fucking video. But like, I think these kind of sitcoms that kind of experiment with like what the actual set, like, I don't know, the actual family dynamic needs to be changed for these to actually continue going.
Yeah, I could see that. But I think also another thing is like sitcoms are still very profitable on networks that people our age don't really watch. Like I can't tell you how many times I've been at my parents' house, the only time I actually watch cable, and there's a commercial for some fucking random show that's like the fire guys or like the firefighters or whatever. And there's
I watched two episodes of this Terry Crews sitcom from like 5 years ago. It was one of the worst things I've ever seen in my fucking life, but apparently it was really popular.
Yeah, so there's a whole, you know, people over 45, 50 that I think they're still, you know, they still got cable. They're still kicking. They're watching that shit.
People
think
watching
there's,
Blue Bloods.
Yeah, I think there's a market
for it. They watch
Law
and Order SVU.
Yeah. And also, I think the you know, the dichotomy between the multicam sitcom and the single cam sitcom, that there was a big revolution in that. Like, I think probably in the mid-2010s where, you know, if they were pitching something back in the 90s or the 2000s that would have been a, you know, live studio audience and multicam, they would do the same thing except just make it look more like a prestige drama, you know? Like,
well, the problem with multicam is it requires much, much smarter writing than single camera sitcoms.
More talented,
like,
performers, too.
Yeah, multicam can still work regardless of what people think. It's just, I don't think, first of all, it's not something people are trained in anymore. Nobody reads multicam scripts and like actually learns how to write the format, because it's very, very different. And for two, I think for network television, I think there's a lot worse writers nowadays, like as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I really buy into that. I don't think that it's worse writers. I think it's just the same thing as it always is. Like, studios less willing to take a chance on ideas that we're going to perceive as fresh and
innovative.
Maybe
the good writers are out there, but they're not working, you know?
I mean, they're either that or they're not given a chance. It's the same argument people have where they go, oh, movies suck nowadays because all they do is make remakes and sequels and reboots. It's like, well, because people are watching them. And yeah, the studios are like, this is a safe bet, so we're going to do that. So they're going to make some inoffensive, mediocre crap that they can get some mediocre writer in, underpay them, yeah, and then there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just sad to see, because I think like sitcoms, like even like That 70s Show was like really smartly written, had really good actors. Like, I would love for a show that like kind of gives me the same feelings that I got from those shows back in the day. Because I don't think that's the same thing I can get from like television or from movies, right? Like, that feeling I got from That 70s Show and that connection to those characters and things like that, it's not emulatable from going to see films.
That's
well,
very true.
As a Zoomer, you know what that sounds like to me? It sounds like you're fucking old. It sounds like you got the rose-tinted glasses on. It's not going to happen, buddy.
I liked when the old guy would tell him he was going to put a boot up his ass. That was my favorite part of the show.
I love it when Sheldon would go, Bazinga.
What's the last show that y'all feel like y'all had like a pretty genuine connection to the characters and like you really like, you know what I mean? Like an actual genuine connection to the characters,
like a new
of a
show?
Television show.
It has to be a sitcom.
And not necessarily a drama. Like, not like a super dramatic show.
Schitt's Creek.
Okay, that's solid.
I mean, Succession is like a tragicomedy, you know. So there, it's sort of like a sitcom in a way. It's very funny. If I had to pick a comedy though, like a straight up comedy, probably Girls. Actually, I love all the characters in Girls.
Girls is
Adam
honestly
Driver's
pretty solid.
In that, right?
Yeah, Adam Driver's in that. Yeah.
I think mine would be like Silicon Valley. I think.
Oh yeah, dude. No, fucking rules.
Silicon Valley's really good. And I also feel pretty genuinely connected to the characters of Righteous Gemstones. So that's a modern one that I think
I need to check
really,
that one out.
Really solid. And honestly, most of Danny McBride's shows I think are really good.
Wait, so Nick, are you specifically missing the multicam vibe though? Is that what part of your video is?
I think I touch on that too. But I think sitcoms as a whole, like, I think are kind of in a rough spot. Even single cam sitcoms.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I do think actually is missing? Because with a lot of shows, specifically with sitcoms, it was so much easier to make them at a non-sloth pace. Where what is one of the biggest problems we're having with so many shows? We're finishing Stranger Things, finally, after what, four different presidential terms? It's absurd. And then you look at something like an Abbott Elementary, where I think they're on like, what, season 4 or 5 after 4 years? Like, they're able to turn them around so much more than these fucking long...
But how much do you think of that is due to the actual writers, the Duffer Brothers or whatever, like, taking their sweet-ass time?
I honestly don't know what the problem is. I think that's just... But that's just generally the current standard for these big shows. They're, like, at least 2 years before you get another season for these big, big shows. Like, Last of Us, 2 years. we have House of the Dragon. It's like 2 years. But I still think it's going to be another 2 years.
Network shows still pump out pretty quick. I mean, like, there's that, there's like a new Tim Allen show on right now that I think there's pumping out seasons pretty fast.
I think the 2 year thing is most like, especially for something like Stranger Things, it's like a twofold problem. CG probably. Thing, it's yeah. Well, yeah, it's a CG, definitely. It's definitely got harder to schedule that show as the kids
all
have gotten
like 50 years old.
Well, no, they're just getting way more famous, you know. All the Stranger Things kids are like the biggest actors of their age demo.
Finn Wolfhard's fucking blowing up, dude.
Yeah. And he can rock out, dude. Have you heard his band?
This Winona Ryder lady, I think she's going to take it off big, you know. She's really good.
Dude, I'm in love with her.
Someone should put her in a Beetlejuice movie.
My wife said she gives like cigarette mom.
Oh, yeah, totally. I'm okay Stranger Things. Are you guys big Stranger Things fans?
I like Stranger Things.
I really like it.
I have complicated feelings because I think season one was great. And after season one finished, I was like, okay, I think they're going to do an anthology thing, which I remember hearing that was the original pitch. They were going to do like a new set of characters in a new thing, but it's all going to be like 80s based sci-fi horror. Mm-hmm. And then season one was so massive. They're like, well, let's do a continuation. And I think season two sucked. Season three was not as bad. And then season four, I was like, damn, they fucking found their footing. All they needed was a goddamn villain.
Yeah, a villain who actually speaks, you know?
Yes, yeah. And isn't just a big sludge monster.
Yeah.
I think it has its problems, but I think the like stuff that you have to compare it to, like the fucking Goonies type stuff, I think it fits very soundly in that realm and does a good job. So like, it's one of those things where like, I'm not going to criticize it because I think it does what it's trying to do very well.
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean,
I think it's the, yeah.
I loved season four. Season three, I was almost out on. When season four came back, I was like, am I even going to watch this? I was like, I didn't.
And that first episode ended.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the fucking Chrissy scene happened.
Yeah. That was what got me back in.
I was like, holy shit, dude. They just fucking murked her so bad.
Yeah. And really it was Vecna for me. I mean, I think there was some controversy, or at least the fans were divided on that. By the way, sorry to change this up, is like Stranger Things fandom is the most annoying fan base online. Have you guys noticed this?
I have never engaged with the Stranger Things
fandom. Yeah, I didn't know there was
like a dedicated fandom.
Just because, I mean, I've been keeping this from you guys for a while, but I'm a massive Reddit head, so I go on all the subreddits of the shows I like, and it's just like, I mean, I'm sure it's because they're
young. Why do you torture yourself like
they're,
that?
They're young kids, just like, they do shipping, you know? You guys know about shipping? Oh, yeah.
I know what shipping is. My wife wrote fan fiction.
Nick, are you a big shipper?
I'm not a big shipper.
I don't believe you, dude. You fucking. I could see Nick getting out of like the first season of a movie. He's like, I just wish the Penguin and Sophia would get together. Like, I could just see.
I can see myself doing that in the right show. Maybe.
They just need
to kiss.
Aaron
Taylor Johnson.
Nick's just like, he's literally just making like little Valentine's Day cards just on doodles. Canva with
like,
the
if
Penguin.
If they cast Aaron Taylor Johnson as Batman, he better kiss Superman.
He'd be a terrible Batman, I'm not gonna lie to you.
Yeah, he's like 5'2".
I would have never expected to hear you say that. I thought you would like him as Batman.
Honestly, I was just thinking about this. I think he was my least favorite part of Nosferatu. I kept thinking he had a fake accent, and then I realized, oh, he's actually British. Why does he sound so off?
And I like him. I thought he was good.
As a Robert De Niro situation.
I think Craven he was pretty bad in, but I mean, whatever.
I mean, no one's going to survive a Sony original superhero movie.
Yeah. I mean,
I like him. I really wish fucking Matthew Vaughn wasn't so terrified of making a third movie in a series. No trilogy he's ever started has been finished. It pisses me off.
It's just Kingsman and Kick-Ass, right?
Yeah.
What didn't he do Argyle recently? Did you guys see that?
Yeah, and that was supposed to be
I heard that was bad. I haven't seen it.
It's a movie about like keeping a little cat in a backpack or something, and you go on a mission.
It's not actually really about.
And Henry
that.
Cavill's there, kinda, and he has a terrible haircut.
So listen, it's a movie about keeping a cat in a backpack, and you got to go on a mission. They get the cat out of the bag. I mean, I don't
know. Someone let the cat out of the bag.
So now this British man is Martin Scorsese. The thing about Matthew Vaughn is like he makes such great stylized films. Have y'all watched Layer Cake before?
No.
Oh my god, it's so good. It has Matthew Craig in it, or Daniel Craig in it.
Matthew Craig.
But like, oh my god, dude, his movies are so fucking good, man. And like, they have no substance either. Like the Kingsman movies are like just completely empty as far as like actual substance.
Beautiful. There's three Kingsman movies.
No, the Kingsman is not. No,
it's a prequel, but that's three. That movie, sir, can that you movie count? Sucks.
No, but they remember they had the whole thing where like they were supposed to make a third one with Channing Tatum coming back as the Texan guy, and they're going to join forces with Kingsman. Yeah.
And then they did the King's Speech.
Oh yeah,
that was the prequel. Yeah. I didn't see the Kingsman, but didn't that have a post credit scene with Hitler?
Bad. It was atrociously bad. It was one of the worst movies I've seen. Yeah, it was so bad.
There's a post-credit scene with Hitler?
I read that it's like
I didn't Thanos stick around if that happened.
Post-credit scene, like Hitler shows up and they're like, oh, and then it ends. I'm a huge
Matthew Vaughn fanboy. I'll literally like suckle anything he releases, but that movie pissed me off.
Is he like a Guy Ritchie type dude?
He's a very Guy Ritchie type dude, yes. I think he
seems to make edgy movies. Like that's kind of his like vibe.
Mm.
He's one of those directors where whatever movie he comes out, they always start it off the trailer by going from the twisted mind of Matthew Vaughn.
he did the X-Men First Class movies and stuff.
Yeah, that was good. That's one of my favorite X-Men movies. Probably my favorite.
Oh, so that marked the beginning of Bryan Singer not doing those movies anymore. Is that what it was?
Well, he came back because Matthew Vaughn was going to do the follow up to First Class, but then PDF file man came back and said, no, I want to make another one. And then he just jumped in there. And
has he come back yet, or is he still
Brian gone? PDF file? No, he's done.
He's you never not know working. With these guys, bro. Yeah. What's his name?
Bryan Singer.
American Beauty guy? What's his name?
Kevin Spacey.
He's coming back. Kevin Spacey's coming back. American Beauty's so good, by the way.
Yeah.
Oh my god, Bryan Singer looks like a pedophile.
Oh, dude! Now we can talk. We can talk about Fight Club because American Beauty reminds me of Fight Club in a way where it doesn't hit as much. I mean, it doesn't. They're
don't,
not
don't
very
spoil
similar.
American Beauty because I still haven't seen it.
I won't spoil it, but they're not very similar movies. But they're similar in the way that they captured like the zeitgeist of that time. You know, I think it was like a year
That's
apart,
true.
Right?
And that's true.
It was like late 90s, right, for American Beauty.
Yeah, like the whole paper bag floating it. This isn't a spoiler, Ethan. It's where
Katie, I've seen the scene. I've seen the scene.
It's where Katy Perry gets the beautiful line from Fireworks from. But
do you ever feel
like that plastic bag? That was supposed to be so deep back in the year 2000, and now you watch it and it's like, why is this guy filming a fucking paper plastic bag?
I do remember because I think I started the movie and then something came up and I was not able to finish it. But I got about half hour through and I was like, oh, Kevin Spacey is a PDF file. and then I got to the plastic bag scene and I was like, if I was sitting next to this dude and he sits me down, he's like, look at this video I filmed. And then shows me a video of a plastic bag. I would just fucking leave.
Whatever right, happened dude, with I'm the Kevin going Spacey back stuff? Home. Was it just that they were like... No, he's definitely really creepy, but we don't know that he's actually a PDF file.
I don't know.
No,
is that what ended up going up there?
Ethan, you were saying he's a PDF file. I think he's just a sex pervert. I'm not sure he's a PDF file.
And sexually like assaults people sometimes.
I listened to a thing about what he was doing the other day, and it's funny we brought this up, because what he would do is he would find actors like, you know, very unknown male actors, and he would be like, you know, I see something in you, kid, let's go on a drive, or let's go, you know, let's go back to my place. And then he for one of these guys, which I thought was very weird, because Kevin Spacey, his dad was he was a Nazi actually, so what he I guess because of that, I don't know if his dad was abusive for sure, but he got this kind of complex around it, so he developed an attraction to like servicemen and stuff like that. So he would put on Saving Private Ryan and then like jerk off next to some guy he just picked up and basically bamboozled into thinking he was gonna make his career if he like gave him a blowjob or something, you know, like sick casting couch shit like that.
What is this?
It's just what happened, bro.
That's where you just fucked. Pray. That's where you get on set with Kevin Spacey and you just pray that you're chosen. You pray and you get that fucking little secret glasses, the filming glasses. You're like, Kevin Spacey, my man. you better fucking make my career, because I don't think people are going to like this.
Yeah, Kevin Spacey's sexual misconduct allegations. In 2017, American actor Kevin Spacey faced several allegations. Began after Anthony Rapp alleged that Spacey, while appearing intoxicated, made sexual advances towards him at a party in 1986 when Rapp was 15 years old and Spacey was 27.
Oh, he is a pedophile. Fuck. You're right, Ethan.
Yeah. I there was actually, I remember, are you guys familiar with the podcast Weekly Planet?
Mm-mm.
It's also a part of the Mr. Sunday Movies YouTube channel. Their podcast, they have one of their Australian friends, had a story about Kevin Spacey. And this is before everything had happened with Kevin Spacey. They made a reference. They're like, oh, should we tell that Kevin Spacey story? And they're like, no, let's not do that. And then after all the allegations came out, they're like, oh, so our friend was like at the airport, met Kevin Spacey. He was like 19. And like was talking to Kevin Spacey, and he's like, oh, Kevin Spacey, I'm a huge fan. And Kevin Spacey was like, oh, let me, like, they were talking, and he like went up to him and was like, let me help you with your belt, and like pulled his like pants forward.
Oh my God.
And then like fiddled with his belt, and he was like, all right, you're good. And yeah. And they're like, anyway, that was the story.
Ugh, dude.
Yeah, pretty gross.
One of the most disgusting things about, I mean, obviously doing all this stuff is horrible too, but it's, do you guys remember when he, all of this information first started coming out? He was one of the first ones after Weinstein to get hit, you know, during the first wave of
the
Me Too
stuff.
Yeah. And after all the guys came out, were accusing him, he's just like, well, yeah, I'm gay. So if that makes anyone feel any differently, I mean, you know, take it easy on me. I'm a gay man. I've been hiding that.
Sorry
for a while.
If you're homophobic.
Yeah. Fuck. He just thought that could get him out of it, you know. It's so fucked up. But I will say, I have to admit, I miss him. I miss Kevin Spacey, bro. He was an amazing actor.
Like, here's my thing.
I mean, yeah, I can separate the
I don't
the
think
person
he can be
from
that
the, he's good at what he did.
I don't think you can be that good of an actor without being somewhat of a fucking psychopath. And I think
Willem
that makes
Dafoe.
Me what yeah. That guy's probably pretty fucking crazy.
He's
very
so genuine
yeah.
and like cool.
He's probably
everyone
kind,
I've heard that's talked to him
I'm not
in
saying,
personal life
I'm not
says
saying you
awesome.
Have to, I'm not saying you have to be an actual like terrible person. I'm just saying you have to have some screws loose possibly.
Yeah.
I want to know what kind of what kind of fucking skeletons are in Daniel Day-Lewis's closets, bro?
Is there, I have a question for you guys. Is there one actor or, let's say actor, but we can expand this to just general celebrity or artist. If they came out and they were a horrible person, which would be the most devastating for you personally?
That's a really good question. I mean,
because
honestly, guys, it happened to me with Louis C.K. And
oh really?
Yeah, Louis was back in 2017. You know, basically ever since I started watching his comedy, I was a major fan of his show, Louis on FX. And then when all those stories came out in 2017, I was absolutely devastated. I was like, "Fuck!" I still think Louis is a genius. I think he's the best comedian of all time. And that was really hard to swallow, all that stuff. But
I'm not very big on. Like idolizing people,
celebrities yeah.
and things like that. Like,
yeah,
you know,
I didn't idolize him. I just loved him. I loved his work. Yeah.
Well, no, I think, well, there's like one exception for me. And like, it's like I can't think of a single famous person or anybody like that, that I would like lose my shit if I saw them, except for Danny McBride
and Aaron Taylor Johnson.
So like, not Aaron Taylor Johnson. I wouldn't lose my mind if I saw him, but if I met Danny McBride, I'd fucking shit my pants probably. So it would really suck if he came out as a bad person.
Yeah. Oh, actually, if never mind. You go, Ethan.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I don't want to go.
It's, okay.
Well,
all right.
Because we said we weren't going to get political, so I don't want to do it.
Well, we can if we want to.
I'll just
it's
do a quick
topic.
Thing. If Bernie, yeah. if it was Bernie Sanders, I would be very upset.
I'd feel a bit betrayed in the same way.
Yeah.
I'd be like, Bernie.
Yeah. But
yeah,
he's good, dude.
Me,
he's been around for so long. It would have happened by now. So we're good. In that respect,
yeah,
he'll die a
yeah.
legend.
Yeah, did you hear he got arrested?
Is that true? Oh, back in the day.
Yeah, it was for a good reason, in a good way.
Yeah, I yeah. remember this.
I have that T-shirt.
For me, honestly, as an actor, it's got to be Willem Dafoe, just because I think he's so fucking amazing and talented, and he's like one of those performers that's not afraid to go big and like own it. As well as just doing a subdued performance, and generally I'll listen to interviews of that guy just talk about making art, and I just think he's so incredible. That would be a devastating one if he came out.
He's basically like, I see him as like a Nicolas Cage, if Nicolas Cage like actually was careful with the roles he picked.
Yeah.
Well, I think Nicolas Cage is weird though. Doesn't he have like a really young wife?
That's, who cares?
No, well, but like a young, like she was like, they met when she was like 18 or 17 or something. I don't know. Maybe I'm talking my ass. I thought I said something about that.
With Willem Dafoe in particular, I was personally surprised he didn't get canceled when he turned the entire board of Oscorp into skeletons on the World Unity Day parade. When
oh my God, his
out am I?
What are you saying, Nick?
Dude, she looks.
What? What?
Look up his wife, bro. I'm not gonna say anything. Just look her up.
Why? What? You have to describe it for our audio only listeners.
So his wife is in this photo from a year ago. He was 56. She was 26.
That's not that bad.
That's how old you are.
That's not
bad. Is it because she's Asian?
She's very traditionally Asian. And it just, in my mind, I was like, I was imagining my uncle who like got a mail order wife type of deal.
He did?
And I just like imagined, like Nicolas Cage, like getting a mail order wife, and it fucked me up.
Can you tell us that story?
I don't really know the full story. He just was just like, one day he just came in. He's like, this is my wife. She's from the Philippines. And we're like, how long ago did you meet her? And he's like, yesterday. Like, okay.
You're like, she seems my cool. Wife.
I don't know. She's cool. She's like, speaks English pretty good now, and she's chill.
I do think that's an interesting thing that happens in Hollywood specifically, just with like all these dudes who, like, Leonardo DiCaprio is probably the biggest culprit, where he has girlfriends that are 18 and then they hit their expiration date at the decrepit age of 25, and then he dumps them and finds another one.
Yeah, you have to think about it this way though, right?
Like, oh no, don't justify this.
I'm gonna justify it. I'm sorry.
Oh fuck,
so,
dude.
as somebody who has been working in Hollywood since they were very young, they probably, and have had all the money they've ever needed, they have probably had very little to force them to actually grow up into like actual adult human beings, and they're probably very, very like regressed emotionally. Like, I think they're probably mentally at the same age as these young women they're going after.
Yeah, especially in Leo's case too, because you guys remember the whole Pussy Posse thing with him and Tobey Maguire?
No.
Yeah,
they literally called themselves the Pussy Posse because they were you know, it was around the time of Titanic and Spider-Man, and they were the young new Hollywood actors. They called themselves like the new Brat Pack or the Pussy Posse, which I think they actually ended up calling themselves, because they would just go pick up chicks and stuff, you know. It's very, very epic behavior, you know. But I don't know.
Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, I could see where you're coming from, Nick, but I don't know. I don't think that's what
I'm not saying that it's. I'm not saying it's literally okay. Like, I think that they
obviously
should.
You're saying that's why you think it happens.
Yeah, I'm not saying they shouldn't just not do that, but like, I think it's understandable for me. Like, I get it.
I mean, I don't know. It's just it's so hard. Like, being 31 now, it's so hard for me to even imagine dating someone that's like 7 years younger than me. Like, I don't know if I could even do that.
But our lives are much, much harder than their lives have been.
Yeah.
And it ages you. Like, honestly, like, I think in the last like year of my life, like, I feel like I've lived like 5 years, you know, just because, I mean, and I think that's kind of what, because it's not until, like, this is way too personal, but like, it's not literally until this year I've actually dated girls that are like older than me. Literally never in my life have I dated somebody not like 5-6 years younger than me.
Mm.
I mean, not always, but like, whatever.
Yeah,
I think, because for me, same thing with you, Kuldrinik. I'm like, I've driven past a high school and I'm like, are those fucking 12-year-olds coming out of the gate?
Yeah,
like, they look like children, like babies. And talking to a high schooler, the like one or two times I have in the last 3 years, I'm like, damn, there is nothing going on up there.
Yeah.
Not like to say they're stupid, but they just, their priorities are in a different place and what they want to talk
about.
Very,
very different from them. I mean,
yeah,
I don't know. I don't necessarily agree with it. I feel like I can understand where they're coming from on it. And I wouldn't do the same, but
I mean, I think whatever. So much, like, I watched the fucking, the Fall of Diddy thing on HBO. I don't know if you guys watched that, but.
They turn those things around so goddamn quick.
I know, right? I was just thinking that too. But it's just like, I think you get to this place of status and power where you, all the things that are supposed to make you feel good, stop making you feel good. And then you just start becoming this like vindictive, psychotic piece of shit. If you're a certain type of person, like you can only get your pleasure receptors only go off when you're fucking hurting someone. Not that Leo, I mean, Leo, I would say his behavior in, you know, in the regard that we're talking about is like mildly predatory though. I mean, it's very strange. You ever see those graphs that go around on social media, like the fucking, the Leo dating graphs where it's like, oh, she turned 26 and then she gets fucking broken up with, you know, like that's very weird behavior. Not to put him on the same level as Diddy at all, you know, I don't think he's doing that, but it's just like, I don't know. I think these guys, they just fucking, they achieve the highest echelons of whatever you can fucking achieve in whatever industry you're in. And you just start getting a little weird. You know, you start turning inward and getting angry or.
Well, imagine what kind of person you'd be if you got everything you wanted, right? Like, I mean, if everything I ever wanted just fell right into my lap, I think I would be a lot more of a narcissistic person.
Yeah. And then you start to like mythologize yourself, like you narrativize your life, like it was always meant to be this way. Like you build like a chosen one myth around yourself, you know. Yeah. I read this thing for a while ago that was like every man in America thinks he's the chosen one until 21 years old. And realities, or I mean, I bet some of them it's older.
21, bro. I think it's older than that, bro.
It's like 25 and 30 for a lot of fucking sad people.
Yeah, I think I still have somewhat of that. I think,
dude, you're jealous of Paul Atreides.
You're like, it should be me.
I think it's
any type of like truly artistic person kind of has to have these sort of like delusional thoughts to some extent, right?
Yeah.
You have to think that you have something, some kind of special sauce to you, even if you don't necessarily have it, right? You have to feel like you have it, or else what the fuck is the point of trying?
Yeah, but there's a difference between that and like I'm talking about these people who do make it. That's why so many celebrities are fucking assholes, because it's like, I think a lot of them don't factor into luck into the equation of how they got where they were, you know, or luck and connections or, you know, happenstance and shit like that. Like I think a lot of them they build up a myth around themselves and they're like, no, everything that I got I worked for, which means all of you are beneath me, you know, all of you who didn't achieve this status, fuck you, I'm the one who deserves everything, you know. Like, I think a lot of them are on that tip, but
that makes sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of shitty celebrities that kind of have that attitude.
Who do you think the worst celebrity is?
Harvey Weinstein.
Oh no! All right, you can't do just sex perverts or whatever.
Not a horrible person. Okay, like just someone I just don't like for no reason.
Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds is starting to piss me off with all his goddamn Mint Mobile ads.
Yeah.
And I just think he's annoying.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, I know Nick is going to say The Rock.
No, it's too easy of a target.
fuck. I'm trying to think who really grinds my fucking gears.
Mark Wahlberg's annoying as well. If I was Ari there Aster, when 9/11 bro. Happened, I could have stopped it.
I fucking hate Ari Aster, dude.
Dude, you just
we're never
just,
getting him. We're never getting him on
Nick,
the podcast.
I listened to the conversation that we had about Midsommar and Hereditary the other day, and I was like, what the fuck were you thinking during that conversation? You were like, Ari, like, I swear to God, he thinks this shit is funny. Like these movies.
This is a comedy.
These movies that are literally the most depressing things that anyone could ever think of. And you're like, no.
I hate his voice.
He thinks
I
it's
hate
funny.
Him.
He thinks it's all a big
There's
joke.
There's just something about him, the way he writes, the way he directs, the way he talks, that irks the shit out of me. I don't know what it is. I think he's going to come out as some kind of creep someday. And I'm going to have this big I told you so moment. I'm just calling it now.
Oh, that kind of brings up another point. Do you think it's possible for someone to think of the fucking weird and horrendous story beats that this guy thinks of and characters and, you know, just be the kind of really disgusting sort of director he is, not disgusting as a person or as a creative. I'm just saying, like, he makes you feel ill a lot with the images he produces. Like, do you think it's possible to be that kind of creative and not be fucked up in some way?
I think it is. I think you have to have seen or experienced things that are not great, or you have to have a really sick mind.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Because I've written some horror stories before, and I don't think I'm too much of a psycho. I mean, I'm, you know, from a scale from like, I don't know, Ron Weasley to Patrick Bateman, I'm probably like a fucking.
I think you've seen some lows, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, you've talked about your experiences. Like, I think there's a lot of correlations you can draw to that, from that to like the feelings you feel of horror, you know.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know why I said Ron Weasley to Patrick Bateman. Like, Ron Weasley.
That was a really weird job.
The least psychotic person in all of fiction. Ron Weasley.
Caillou to Patrick Bateman.
So, Nick, what are you recommending for us next week, bro?
Oh, wait, real quick. Hold on. Nick, I want you to know, do you know anything about Ari Aster's next film?
Eddington, right? The
it's Eddington. It is described as a Western noir ensemble movie set during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Oh, sick.
And it's starring Joaquin Phoenix, Emma Stone, Austin Butler, and Pedro Pascal.
Why is he always working with fucking Joaquin, bro?
Because Joaquin, he loves Joaquin, even though
That's
Joaquin walks out
true.
On movies.
It's only one time.
You're like, why is he always working with the most talented God. Actor in the history of fucking Hollywood? Like, why wouldn't you? He's amazing. He's Joaquin, bro.
I'm telling you, it's blind hatred. And the day he makes a movie I like, I'm going to be so mad. Because I'm going to have to admit it, and I'm going to be pissed.
Well, you can still not like the other ones.
Yeah, that's fine.
I know, but I don't want to say anything nice about him. So I'm hoping his next movie sucks.
There's the strange thing about the Joneses. You'd love that.
I talked about this on the podcast about how much I fucking hated it. Okay, so I'm going to be recommending Chungking Express by Wong Kar-wai.
What?
And it is one of my favorite movies.
What's it called?
And I'm really excited for y'all to see it.
Chungking Express.
Chung, how do you spell
it's
it?
It's on Amazon. It's on HBO Max.
Oh, sick!
It's a real movie.
I've been having to rent the past couple ones, so that's nice. This is already
just
in Max.
Watch it online.
Did you rent
through
Love
whatever
and Pop?
Means?
No.
Huh?
No.
Okay.
I there was no way to even rent that.
Yeah, it's not available on anything.
I watched it on
this
YouTube.
This is sort of a romance movie. I would say it's definitely a romance movie. I wouldn't say it focuses super strong on like the love aspect as much as like the individual feelings these people are going through.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen this movie a couple times and I really want to watch it again, and I think y'all are gonna love it.
Yeah, we should reiterate for the people who are listening, we're doing the romance month. So it's gonna be, you know, starting off with Upstream Color, then Chungking Express, then Captain America Brave New World, and then When Harry Met Sally. So it's all about the love this month in February, guys.
Yeah. Can't wait to see Harrison Ford's Red Hulk give a big smooch to Captain America.
Mm-hmm.
Mwah.
But yeah. All right, boys.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for watching. If you really enjoyed this episode and you're listening to it on YouTube, please leave us a like and a comment. We'd really appreciate it. Or if you're listening to this on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, leave us a 5-star review, because that really helps us out a lot and makes us feel really, really good.
Hell
so
yeah.
If you don't want to be spoiled for Chungking Express, directed by Wong Kar-wai, next episode, then watch it. And I think that's pretty much it. Get Stuckmanized, everybody.
Get Stuckmanized.
Get Stuckmanized, everybody.